Hello, and welcome to Rabble Radio. It's Friday, July 22nd, 2022. I'm your host, Brianne Doyle. Thanks so much for tuning in. And thanks so much for podcast host extraordinaire Wayne McPhail for filling in for me last week. Rabble's got its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us, free of corporate influence. The concept of a guaranteed basic income has gained a lot of attention over the past few years. And on Rabble, the idea has been discussed, debated, and deliberated from a variety of angles. In May this year, MP Leah Gazan and Senator Kim Pate joined us for our Off the Hill political panel series, talking about their proposed bills, Bill S-233 and Bill C-223, which urge the government to implement a guaranteed livable basic income. They believe that a guaranteed livable basic income is a tool, not a final solution, to combat the growing inequality in Canada. They explained that there are other income guaranteed programs already in place in Canada, such as EI, the Canada Child Benefit, and social assistance. With Bill S-233 and Bill C-223, Senator Pate and MP Gazan want to make current income guarantees livable and to expand them out for those falling through the cracks, such as adults with disabilities, people living in extreme poverty, and Indigenous peoples. However, there are those who believe that a basic income isn't key in solving inequality in Canada. Some argue that a program like basic income cannot adequately address the many issues that contribute to poverty in our country, such as the cost of housing, poor labor standards, access to healthcare and childcare, and so on. Basic income, or a guaranteed income, the term has many different names and means different things to different groups. Today, Doreen Nichol speaks to Ron Heichel, a political scientist who has spent decades studying the economics of a guaranteed minimum income. They discuss what it would actually take to make a basic income program work in Canada. Heichel is a longtime advocate for a universal basic income. In the 70s, he worked on the MINCOM project, a guaranteed annual income pilot program in Manitoba. Around this time, he was also responsible for the Manitoba welfare system. Later, he went on to run social services in Saskatchewan. Heichel has worked as a professor, a public servant, a consultant, and today, Heichel is at work on a book detailing federal failures in the delivery of public services. Doreen Nichol is a social activist, freelance writer, and frequent contributor to Rabble.ca. In 2016, she won the Hamilton Independent Media Award for Social Justice and Human Rights. Here are Nichol and Heichel in conversation. Take a listen.
So, Ron, I think there's a lot of confusion around the guaranteed livable income.
Yes.
And the operational details of that, because that must be massively complicated.
It is. Here's my central point. There are three key components that need to be sorted out. First is, what is your objective? What change in some aspect of society do you most want to accomplish by the establishment of a guaranteed income program? What is your fundamental policy objective? The second point is that you then have to identify the specific operational design that will deliver on your first point. And thirdly, what you have to do is to make sure that your policy objective and your delivery mechanisms are perfectly aligned so that the system you put in place is capable to delivering the objective that you want to accomplish. The problem at the moment with basic income is that not only is there no agreement about the title, but there's no agreement about what it is or how you're going to go about accomplishing it. And in fact, there are radically different, and I would say conflicting versions of how that system, the delivery system, should be designed and managed. And that is a problem because while there are an increasing number of people in the country who are advocating for basic income and trying to push governments various levels into doing it, they're calling for different things. They're calling for things that are conflicting, that cancel each other out. So my view is the first thing you have to do if you think you're a basic income advocate is to identify your objective. Secondly, you've got to stipulate the operational mechanisms that aren't there now to be put in place to achieve that objective. And third, you have to be absolutely sure that that those two are aligned. The purpose of basic income, in my point of view, would be to take the largest possible bite out of the financial insecurity that is contributing, among other things, to the additional cost of the healthcare system. That, in turn, requires a system that allows you to collect on a current basis information from individuals and families with insufficient income, just how insufficient their income is, and then to make payments to them quickly to meet the basic cost of survival. And from my point of view, the suggestion that that system can be operated through the income tax system is profoundly wrong. And the reason it's wrong is because the information that the income tax system can have on your income can be as much as a year out of date. But it is, in fact, an established reality that one of the characteristics of being a lower income person is that, first of all, your employment status is highly questionable, the whole notion of the gig economy. You can't be certain how many hours you're going to get to work this week or next week, or let alone a month from now. And secondly, the actual income from working, from employment, is highly variable. And the poorer you are, the more variable it is, which means that if you see the financial insecurity, physical and psychological, as the major objective to be overcome, that you then need a system that can collect information on a current basis from low-income people and turn that into a check to go into their bank account. That the longer the time between the time you receive some income from working and the time you report it, the less accurate your reporting is likely to be. There is a profound need for the creation of a system that can operate on the basis of current reporting from the recipient or the family head, whatever, about your current income resources and the gap between what you're going to have and what the system says you need to meet your basic cost of living. That the development of that system could be done with both relatively low cost and certainty, in my view, by the private sector, not by the public sector. The public sector's record of developing highly efficient and relatively low-cost information processing systems is unfortunately not very good. I also know it to be the case that there are people in the private sector who are running systems that are already doing exactly what I'm talking about, who would be interested in participating in the development of that system. And it would be beneficial, from my point of view, for the government's concerned to have visible public support from the private sector for the development of exactly that system.
So that sounds like EI that you've described, that wouldn't work for guaranteed income?
I don't think so, no. Because what I would do, frankly, is to create a system in which somebody who feels they have a low income and uncertain employment, every Friday or every two Fridays or every once a month, would use this thing, his cell phone, and report to the people running the program by 5 o'clock on Friday how much income they've had for the last 2 weeks or the last month. And the system can then turn that around very quickly and put a check into their bank account on Monday. If you think about basic income from the perspective of how do you make it maximally appealing to the men and women sitting around the cabinet table, you want to be able to assure them that you're achieving the greatest possible benefit at the lowest possible cost and with the least risk of fraudulent conduct, which makes the up-to-date and short-term reporting on your income resources incredibly important. One of the things that's required to operate the system is a definition of the additional income that you're going to take into account when you calculate somebody's financial needs. So if you establish for a region or an area the amount of income by family size, which is what I would do, they will then report what their received transfer and earned income is. And that allows you very quickly to calculate the amount of the check that you need to send to them. So, and that is the only way, quite literally the only way, in which you can make the maximum contribution to reducing the negative psychological effects of financial insecurity. Without that system, you can't make those calculations, and therefore you can't make those payments.
So how do you strengthen the work incentive then? I was at a workshop maybe last month, and they were talking about guaranteed work in conjunction with like basic income.
There are a number of things that you could do, again, in the design of the payment system that can do that. For example, the system would say, okay, if your income is below this designated minimum by family size, we need to know how much below the designated minimum your actual in-kant income is in order to make you an adequate payment. And it's central to the achievement of the objective that that payment is in exactly the right amount, allowing you to take care of your family. And that's a critical notion. So the definition of whatever that income is that's going to be counted against your requirement, it needs to be very clear. Beyond that, what you need to do is to be able to stipulate how that those calculations are going to be made so that you're relying on, as I said before, the most recent information that's available. That's how you go about reducing the financial insecurity. To strengthen work incentives, any basic income system would have what's called a tax rate or a reduction rate. And what that means is if you go out in a week and you earn $500, the question becomes, how much do I reduce your entitlement to additional income supplementation by in response to the fact that this week you earn $500? That number is called the tax rate. Basically, it's a percentage of what the additional income that you've received that will serve to reduce the total amount that you've got coming to you. It's a tax rate, but not like an income tax rate. So what I would do to intensify work is for the first $500 a month, for example, that you, in additional earned income, I would ignore it. I wouldn't use it to reduce the amount that you're entitled to. But at some point, you would begin to reduce the amount that a person is entitled to by some percentage of the additional income that they have. Typically, because it seems to be roughly fair, the ultimate amount would be 50%. So that if 50% of your earned income equaled the minimum to which you were entitled, you wouldn't get any money then in that period, because you would have received more than our system judges is required. So for the first, say $500, I would ignore it completely so that everybody in the system has $500 worth of incentive to go out and find a job and keep it and earn $500. So you get to keep the 500 plus the entirety of the additional income supplement. Then I would put in effect after the first $500, say a 25% reduction rate, in which the check you're going to get from the system would be reduced by 25% of whatever it is you'd earned. And at some point above that, I would reduce it by 50%. If you do that, everybody in the system automatically is better off, what, if they go to work? And then the question becomes not whether they're working, but how much they're making or have actually made in a period that has just passed. Because it's critical that the calculations you're making are based on what they have actually received, not what they think they're going to get. And if you do that on a current basis, then you've got a system that is operating at the least possible cost with the greatest possible effectiveness. And that's what you want to do to make it sellable politically.
That makes sense. You may have answered this one, how to reduce the financial insecurity to maximize possible to the maximum possible extent.
I think you base the system, first of all, on some variation in the establishment of the minimal amount that you need by family size. People live in a family, they can economize. It's cheaper for five people to rent an apartment than it is for five individuals to each go out and rent an apartment, for example. So you need to establish a minimum amount by family size that any applicant who's applying for income supplementation objectively needs in that part of the country, because the cost of living varies from one part of the country to another, particularly from north to south. So you need a minimum income that the person needs to have in order to meet the cost of living, with the system then being able to make up the difference between what they actually have and the amount that you have determined they're going to need to meet the basic cost of life.
And this would all replace welfare, this system?
Yes. I mean, while I was running MINCOM, I was also running a provincial welfare system and went on to Saskatchewan to run the welfare system there, and have done consulting around the welfare system with another three or four provinces. Provinces have the constitutional responsibility for the welfare system. It is a provincial program, not a federal program. Some people don't seem to know that, but it's true. The provinces need to make the welfare system payments. The problem with the welfare system is that it can be enormously degrading. In many cases, can ask you, well, Doreen, why aren't you making enough money to meet the cost of your three children and yourself? Fairly shortly after they start that conversation, somebody's going to ask you how it is that you have three kids and no husband. You've then got to provide an answer. That itself, I think, can be a little degrading. The only fact that should count in determining the existence of a payment from the state to somebody with a low income is this one. How short does your income that you have available fall below that amount? If you have sufficient income, thanks very much, enjoy your life. If you have insufficient income, that's the only question that should be asked. Not anything at all about the conditions which may have led to your having insufficient income. If it is insufficient, then you have a payment coming. And the size of that payment is determined by the amount of your insufficiency. That's what you need that system to ask. So what I would do is begin to use the principles of basic income, including particularly the payment calculation system, to replace the provincial welfare system. But I would do it probably on a test basis. Just take a small part of the province of Ontario, a town, you know, a smaller city, for example, and tell everybody who lives in that area, we have this new system. It's not welfare anymore. It's basic income, and run it for 6 months, a year, learn from it, and then expand it from there to convert, in effect, the welfare or social assistance, as it's probably called, program in every province gradually into a basic income system. That's what I would do.
I could see the people who take care of the welfare system at the government level, the employees, not being happy.
Well, interesting that you should say that. A couple of years ago, I did a session with my former employer, KPMG, for a number of public servants and some outsiders who are interested in basic income. And at the end of that session, a guy came up to me and said, "Hi, I'm Bob, and I am responsible for the welfare system in Ontario. Would you come down and talk to us?" And I said, "Sure." So I did, went down to Queen's Park, went in the right door, met these guys. And it became very clear very quickly that they were intensely opposed to replacing the existing welfare system with the basic income system. Partly, I think, because some of them just didn't want to lose their jobs, but also because I think some of them were convinced that it was kind of a personal insult if the system they had been working with or for could be replaced by a better one. They'd been backing the wrong horse, so to speak. So it's undoubtedly the case that some of the people currently involved in the welfare system would not be enthusiastic about replacing it with basic income. On the other hand, some of them would be. Now, what are the proportions of smiling and frowning? I don't know, but I'd certainly like to find out.
I just want to go back to it being run by a private business.
This would be a private business that wouldn't be running the system at all. They would be operating under contract to the provincial government, and they would have to compete. What would happen is you'd put out a tender. The government of Ontario, government of Manitoba would put out a tender or call for proposals. We want proposals that are able to provide this level of service at the highest level of efficiency and the lowest possible cost. And if you think you can do that, make me a proposal. And you'd get 5 or 6 or 8 or 10 proposals. And then you'd go through them and pick out the one that you think is the most persuasive at the lowest cost and with the highest degree of administrative efficiency. And you'd sign a contract that would stipulate what they have to provide and the length that the contract will run. Closure of that agreement could be brought about at any point that in which the province decided that the agency involved was no longer performing satisfactorily.
Okay, so they're just doing the administration.
No, I would allow the interview, the reporting to be done by the individuals involved. As I said, using a cell phone, so there's no face-to-face, no need to somebody to go and knock on your door and let the neighbors know that Fred from welfare has just come to see you. It would be done on a totally confidential basis.
And I guess that would allow people who maybe don't have an address to take part in this.
Absolutely, sure. I think what I would do would be also to recommend the opening of a number of offices around the province, so that if somebody doesn't have a cell phone or doesn't feel confident that they can fill out the report, can go into this office, sit down in front of somebody's desk and say, okay, here's my pay stub, where do I sign? So that, and there'll be people who, it's just as there are people who don't file income tax, there would be people who don't have a cell phone or don't want to operate it. Okay, fine. All I have to do is go to this office, or perhaps even pick up a phone and call them and talk to them over the phone, right? So there are ways to deal with the gathering of information that do not assail one's dignity.
That was Ron Heichel and Doreen Nickel speaking on a guaranteed livable basic income in Canada. Thanks very much for that, Doreen and Ron. Now it's time for a segment we call In Case You Missed It. And for that, I'll hand it over to the editor of Rabble.ca, Nick Seabrook.
Thanks, Brianne. This week on the site, Stephen Wenzel reports, while the Canadian government has announced their intention to claw back CERB payments from those they consider ineligible, new census data shows that most who applied were entitled to the benefits. Only around 10% of Canadians who received money through the government pandemic relief programs were ineligible to do so, according to the 2021 census. Over two-thirds of Canadian adults received income from at least one pandemic relief program, and more than 4 million Canadians also received provincial or territorial relief payments. The median amount received in 2020 was $8,000. Campaign 2000, a nonprofit organization dedicated to ending child and family poverty, is asking the federal government to grant an amnesty on pandemic relief payments and to continue funding those programs. We strongly recommend that the federal government continue income benefits for individuals and ensure that past emergency benefit programs are not penalizing people who have low incomes and leaving them in greater distress, states Campaign 2000 National Director Laila Sarangi. Also on the site this week, is Pierre Poilievre really pro-choice? Joyce Arthur, Executive Director of the Abortion Rights Coalition of Canada, argues no in her latest piece for Rabble. While the Conservative leadership frontrunner may be touting pro-choice rhetoric now, Arthur argues it's reasonable to wonder if Poilievre's assertions are genuine. After all, he's waffled on other issues in the past as well, including same-sex marriage. Voters should not trust Poilievre's convenient flip-flop on his abortion views, Arthur writes. If he ever became Prime Minister, not only would he allow free votes on private member bills that challenge reproductive rights, it's likely he would take other regressive steps. The best case scenario is that a Prime Minister Poilievre might do nothing at all on the abortion issue. That's simply not good enough. In labor news, Gabriela Kaluga-Kasuga reports on the national shortage of healthcare professionals in Canada. The problems caused by the nursing shortage have only been exacerbated since the COVID-19 pandemic. According to the president of the Canadian Federation of Nurses Unions, Linda Silas, one in two nurses are considering leaving their job in the next year, and 94% are showing signs of burnout. Linda Silas believes the quality of patient care will deteriorate further than it already has as the staffing shortage grows. Until action can be taken to address the heavy load on nurses and healthcare professionals, Silas says, Canada's healthcare system will continue to suffer. Finally, tensions between a landlord and their tenants in a Toronto apartment building reached a boiling point last month. More than 50 tenants at 130 Jamison Avenue in Toronto's Parkdale neighborhood received eviction notices from Myriad Property Management, which manages the building, over their use of air conditioning units in their homes. The landlord is giving the tenants the option to either pay them a fee, enter into an agreement with their electricity provider to cover the cost of the air conditioner, remove the air conditioner entirely, or vacate their apartment. This comes amongst not only an oppressive heat wave sweeping Ontario, but also as rental prices continue to skyrocket. According to TorontoRentals.com, the average rental price in the city has risen by 16.5% since the previous year. Landlords normally can only raise a tenant's rent by a maximum of 1.2% a year, but can raise the rent on a vacant property to as high as the market can bear. This incentivizes landlords to evict tenants in order to raise rents. You can catch all of those stories and much, much more on Rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. The last thing we'd like to leave you with, listeners, is this. At a time when freedom and fairness are under attack, whether it be due to the rise of hate in Canada or the recent overturning of Roe v. Wade in the States, grassroots movements are the first line of offense. Amid our annual summer fundraising campaign, Rabble founder Judy Rebick discusses why Rabble's dedication to amplifying progressive social movements is so critical right now, and how you can join her on the front lines of grassroots activism.
Hi, I'm Judy Rebick, and I'm the founding publisher of Rabble.ca. Very proud at this point, more than 20 years after we launched Rabble from the streets of Quebec City, to once again ask you for your support. Rabble provides a space for social movements, protesters, activists, and progressives to read about what people are doing, which we often don't get to do in the mainstream press, to discuss key issues, and to debate those things that we need to debate. It's never been more important to have alternative perspectives and points of view, and Rabble provides them. Please give us your support. Thank you.
Each and every contribution to Rabble makes a difference. Your generous donations go toward planning long-term editorial projects and partnerships, supporting the growth of our editorial team, and arming individuals with truthful reporting in the face of corporate misinformation. Visit rabble.ca/donate for more on how you can join the Rabble resistance to corporate media today. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you have feedback for the show, ideas, stories, opinions you'd like us to cover, we'd love to hear about it. Get in touch with us anytime at editor@rabble.ca. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on Rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.